Welcome to the last episode of season 3. This year has certainly been a whirlwind, and we have appreciated you for coming on and listening to us. Who knows, we might pop on a little bit in the summer. But for right now, we're going to close this season off with a conversation about school choice with Elizabeth Matthew. She's a Philadelphia-based writer and editor. She recently completed the writing fellowship with America's Future Foundation. Matthew writes about education, culture, politics, and religion. Her work has appeared in The Hill, American Magazine, Femme Catholic, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. She has also edited and copyrighted popular articles, academic articles, dissertations, books, textbooks, and standardized tests. For more than a decade, Matthew was a professor and university administrator. She holds a bachelor's in English from the University of Pennsylvania, a master's in English from Penn State, and a doctorate in education from St. Joseph's University. We hope you enjoy everything that Elizabeth has to share with us on this episode, and stick around till the end where Ryan and I give our thoughts on the episode and invite you to share with us any thoughts or ideas you have for future episodes. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit, the podcast that brings you the change makers in education. Tune in to hear from educational leaders who aren't content with the status quo educational model and are blazing their own path.
All right, everybody, welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit. Today we have Elizabeth Matthew on with us. She is going to tell us all about herself because I already forgot her cool term for this, voice of the young or youth voice. But we'd like you to, well, actually, first, just welcome to the show, and then I'll jump into questions. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to be thanks here. A lot.
All right. You hinted at us that you actually have an educational background, and we have you on to talk a little bit about school choice, maybe primarily, but we want to dig into your educational history, because that is what we are. It's an educational show. So just tell us about your career journey. How did you get from, teaching English at the higher ed level to where you are now? Or go back earlier if you want to.
Oh, thank you so much. So I began expecting that I would become a college professor. I wanted to teach literature. I loved literature. I had some great English teachers as a kid, and my home was filled with books. You know, I cultivated that love of reading very early on from really my parents. And when I got to college, I majored in English and was pretty sure that that's the direction I would take. And I did wind up starting a PhD program in English and just loving it and getting really deep into 19th century American literature and the study of that. That was kind of my area. But I also found that I loved the teaching I was doing as part of that graduate program. So as part of my assistantship, I was teaching freshman writing, and I really enjoyed that. And I learned over time that, you know, the job market, as we all know, in higher education is quite tight. At the time I had, you know, my own family and then also a boyfriend back in Philadelphia, which is where I call home. And I was away at school and realizing that I could not necessarily command a job in my field back home, because you can't do that these days, but I probably could command one in teaching at the higher ed level in writing, which I also had found I really loved. I transferred to a program in higher education and completed my doctorate back home at a university in Philadelphia, St. Joseph's University, and began teaching, writing at first part-time as a graduate student and then full-time. And I did that for a while. I wound up as a non-tenure track faculty member at Temple University, where I taught writing in the business school. And then later as the associate director of an online program at the University of Pennsylvania, where I taught leadership and communication and was in charge of the writing courses as well as the curricular development for non-traditional students enrolled in that program. So my experience in education ranges from sort of the very traditional 18 to 22 year olds on campus to people that are coming back to school after maybe a hiatus in their 30s, 40s, and even 50s. So I really kind of got to see all those different aspects of education. And over time, I began freelance writing because I had never really, the itch to read and write about what I read had never really left me after I left my program in English. And I began writing for a Catholic magazine called America Magazine, the Jesuit Review, and then eventually for a couple other publications. And this past August, my family was in a position for me to be able to stop working in higher ed and commit to writing full time. So I've been able to pursue educational topics from the vantage point of a writer and researcher, as well as, you know, other cultural, political, and religious topics.
Wow. What an adventure that you've been on. Let me just interject real quick, though, because I've noticed a pattern. No offense to any of our other listeners, but Ryan and I are both, we have an English language arts background with being former language arts teachers. And I sure have enjoyed our time with some of our other guests that have ELA teaching degrees as well. So I am super excited now that I know that we have a common degree in college. So.
Yes, absolutely. There's nothing better than reading books, right?
Reading or writing. So speaking of that, because we do want to talk, because I know that you've done some work with school choice, but before we get into that, you know, it's interesting that you're a higher ed teacher. I'm curious in your experience, and I know, when's the last time you taught?
I was teaching until this past August.
Okay, so so relatively recently. Mm-hmm. So you're getting the students in the higher ed after they finish their K-12 educational experience. Mm-hmm. So as a higher ed teacher, I don't want to say where are we failing, but where can K-12 do better to prepare students for their experience in a higher education institution?
Sure. That's a great question. I think one of the biggest areas, and I think this is something that, you know, this is not going to be anything new to your listeners, writing is a huge problem, right? Because yep. Writing is something that it isn't just done in one context. And often students, they kind of know how to write an English paper that is the type that they were supposed to produce for the AP, you know, literature class.
Yeah.
And they might also know how to write a text message or, you know, a tweet or an Instagram post, but right. They really don't know how to write for communicative purposes, to convince somebody of something in a practical way. And that's a lot of the writing that they're going to be expected to do both in higher education and later in their careers. And because I focused on a lot of professionally oriented writing, that was definitely a huge part of my focus.
Yeah. And, you know, just thinking in terms of what's expected of where I'm at the middle school level, and that's where I've worked with Ryan at, even though now he's at a K-12, but when you look at standards, they are so heavily weighted on the reading, and that seems to be the focus, that writing is kind of getting, it's almost becoming a lost art. And that's unfortunate, because as an ELA teacher, like, I would kind of teach writing and reading in the same fashion, right? Because in order to write a coherent story, you know, you need to kind of understand the parts of a story and how those work together. And in order to read a story, you need to understand how they work together. And it kind of goes hand in hand, but a lot of times it's not taught that way. It's only taught reading.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really hard to read well if you can't write, and it's hard to write well if you don't read clearly.
Yeah.
So, you know, the two are definitely not entirely extricable, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think what a great segue to talking about school choice. So is school choice an option? I know you wrote an article about this. Tell us a little bit more about, you could start high level, pros and cons of school choice. Tell us more.
Sure. Thank you. So school choice essentially is the idea that the money that we spend on education as a society should follow a student rather than a district. Right. So right now, your zip code determines where the government will pay for you to go to school. And the idea of school choice is that your parents should determine that. Right. Your parents should, whatever the government's paying per student, they should be able to take that money and either continue to send you to whatever the public school is in your district, or choose a charter school, or choose a parochial school, or choose a private school, or homeschool, and use that money for materials and to subsidize income that they can't make because they're homeschooling. So that's sort of the idea of school choice, is that parents, rather than, you know, a government bureaucracy, should control those dollars. And I think that's a great way to go forward in education. I think a lot of Americans agree with that. The numbers now are up between 2/3 and 80% of Americans are in favor broadly of school choice. And a lot of Democratic governors, in particular in Pennsylvania, where I live, our Democratic governor, Josh Shapiro, ran on a platform of school choice, which is unusual. Usually that's been a Republican talking point and issue. Mm-hmm. And now you're seeing more Democrats come on board with that because they understand that constituents, especially in urban areas where Democrats tend to be in power, want it. And so while teachers' unions tend not to favor school choice, and where many public schools writ large have been considered and some continue to be against school choice, there is also a lot of mixed sentiment moving toward the idea that school choice might help everyone at this point, particularly by enabling the students that are in districts that are not performing well to have more opportunities that all the other students already have. And that's sort of the point that I was really trying to make in the article that I wrote in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, is that we already have school choice in this country, right? Whether your state has school choice or not, a lot of students do have it. I live in a public school district where I don't send my children. I send them to Catholic school. I'm able to do that because I have the financial resources to do it. So that is school choice. I have friends that live in school districts where they want to send their children, where housing is and taxes are a lot more expensive than they might be where I live. And those folks moved there, right, for those schools. That's also school choice.
Right.
And
right.
So school choice exists already for everybody except for the people who don't have the financial resources to exercise it. And where I'm from, Philadelphia, that tends to be people who are socioeconomically advantaged, disadvantaged, predominantly minorities, in schools that have been producing results that parents are not super pleased with for several generations now.
Well, help me understand this, because I've always been curious about school choice. And I don't know, I know it's different throughout the country, at different states, the actual funding per student. So if school choice is like, okay, I don't want my student to go to a parochial or to a public school, I'd rather them go to a parochial school, right? And let's say that that state funds, I don't know, $13,000 per kid. Then school choice would say, I'm still going to get that 13 grand, but I get to apply it to my parochial school of choice. But the parochial school of choice does not cost $13,000 to send a child to, at least in my state, because the way that works is just through tithing. You know, I pay a certain amount and then I have to tithe a certain percent of my income. Uh-huh. Where would that money go? Would it go to the school? Would it go to the person then to entrust them that they're going to use it the way that they're supposed to use it?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are all different mechanisms for doing this. And I think that someone, the idea of a pure voucher where it's just like the state spends $13,000, here's your check for $13,000, do whatever you want with it, right? Yeah. That's one sort of way to do it. Another way is tax credits that go to people for specifically toward education, right? Where we pay directly to the school for whatever that school costs to educate that child. And if, you know, $13,000 would not cover a private academy,
sure,
in Philadelphia, right? And so you would have to make up the difference, right? The state's not going to give you more than that if that's the school that you choose, but it would more than cover a parochial school. It'd be double, right, what a parochial school costs. And so whether the parent would keep that money or whether that would be absorbed back into a system in some way, different states will have different ideas about how to do that, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, those details are super important because, you know, the devil's always in the details in terms of how these things actually get done. But the pure voucher system where, you know, they say, here's your 13,000, that is one, you know, method. Typically, yeah. The amount that people are talking about for vouchers hasn't been quite that high, yeah. Even if that's what public schools are spending. So I've heard.
I have no idea. I just made up a number in my head.
Yeah, no, I think that's on par with what public schools are often spending. But I think that vouchers, at least so far as I've heard, have often been more in the 7,000, 8,000, 9,000, you know, vicinity, which would cover a parochial school.
So for the sake of time, because I know we're a little pressed here, why are, like, just thinking through that whole, why are families making that choice? Obviously, it must be successful elsewhere. It's not just, I wouldn't pull my kid out of one system to put him in a crappy other system. So do you have any examples of, like, model schools or success data that's either nationwide, state specific? I don't really care, but just where is the data that's saying this is worth the jump?
So I think that's a great question. I don't necessarily want to say that private or parochial schools are better than public schools, because I don't think that's true.
Right.
I think the idea is that individual families that live in specific places will have specific choices based on their specific child and the specific schools around them, right? So, for example, it is true that during COVID, when a lot of public schools, particularly on the East Coast, were just closed, and, you know, I think now there's broad consensus around the idea that that was sort of a disaster, right, educationally and culturally and otherwise, parochial schools mostly stayed open and the test scores did not drop, right? So that was a great success of people that made the choice to put their children in a school where they had access to school that was open and was continuing to instruct in the traditionally, you know, doors open way. It's also the case that there are private and parochial schools that, you know, probably don't add nearly that much value. So it's obviously specific to the person and the place. I think that overall school choice is really parental choice, right? It's really just putting that power back into the hands of parents. And that, I think, is why it's such a popular measure, because most people trust that parents want what's best for their children, or at least they want what they believe to be best for their children.
Yeah,
that makes sense. I heard this, or I read this article, and I wish I could find it again, but this guy had written this article that was, what if we chose grocery stores like we chose public schools? And by choose, meaning we don't, that you're stuck with whatever grocery store is in your neighborhood,
right?
And you have no choice about what produce is provided in the produce department or what's put on the shelves. And if you want to move somewhere else, well, you got to move somewhere else just to go shop somewhere else. And I thought, what a powerful analogy.
Yeah, so, absolutely. And most people wouldn't, you know, be comfortable or happy with that.
Right.
You know, it's frustrating to me, because I went to parochial school growing up, and my children went to parochial schools, and I've worked in public school my whole professional career. And the teachers in those parochial schools are not better than the teachers teaching in the public schools, yet they get far different results. And I hate to move into some controversial ground here, because that's where I'm going. I guess we'll just go ahead and go there. But how can we get better results in our public schools so people don't want to choose to leave them? You know what I mean? Or even if you leave a public school and you go to a parochial school, you're still making a choice to go to a school that essentially operates under the exact same circumstance. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so we want to think about how can education be completely different? And I guess that would be maybe some more of a charter school angle. But have you heard of any schools that are just really getting some results because they're just the way they do things is so far outside the box than what they're getting in their school that they have to go to, that they actually choose to go to this other school because they want a different experience.
Yeah, I think so. One of the issues that separates public schools from parochial and other private and many charter schools in a lot of big cities is safety, right? Yeah. So one of the basic things that makes them very different is that often there are, you know, longstanding issues that there aren't sufficient resources in the public school to keep the students feeling as comfortable and safe there as they could, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that's environmental safety like asbestos, or whether that's, you know, personal safety like violence. So that's one of the issues where I think things can be different. Another issue is parental involvement. So the level of parental involvement that a lot of parents that choose schools that aren't public bring isn't because they're not in public school. It's sort of one of these, you know, chicken and egg things. Like, they're the same parents that are have the resources to send their kid somewhere that's not a public school that they don't necessarily want to be in. And so they're the same parents that are super involved. But I think that out in, you know, public school districts that are super well funded, you have a lot of very involved parents there too. So I don't necessarily think that the issue is public versus non-public school so much as it's resources versus non-resources, right? Okay. And public schools that that are flush with resources are doing quite well educationally, right? Because they're flush with families that are choosing to be there. The people that go and buy houses that cost three times as much as, you know, the houses in districts where people don't necessarily want to be,
right,
in order to send their kids to that public school district, are exercising a type of school choice.
Yeah.
They are doing it with their tax and real estate dollars, right? But to my mind, we want to have everybody have that same power. And so there will be public schools. There are public schools in the city of Philadelphia, for example, that perform well, mostly because they are in places where people with resources tend to live, right? And so those people cluster in areas. And then because they cluster there, those areas have resources. And so you have schools that perform well. People will choose to go where the good education is for their kids, is sort of what I would trust. And so to my mind, whether that's sending their child to a district where they can afford to move, or whether that's sending their child to a parochial or private school with voucher money that they got from the state, to my mind, it's sort of the same thing. People with the resources already make those choices, even if that choice is another public school.
And what, so when you're talking resources, then you're talking, because there are public schools that maybe in inner city that are just getting cash just dumped on them, right?
Yep.
And but yet there's not necessarily the results from all those financial resources. But you're talking about some social capital resources with involvement and just a invested experience from the family to the kid to everybody. Or are you talking financial resources?
I think it's both. And it's not just the financial resources of the school, because as you say, more money hasn't fixed this problem. Right. Like, more money funneled into the same system has not fixed the problem. But a child that is in a school that is socioeconomically mixed in terms of the students, as opposed to, you know, if you're in a place where every single kid in a given place is disadvantaged socioeconomically, like from their home, and they tend to have a lot of the issues that kids who are socioeconomically disadvantaged have, right? Because they haven't been exposed to the same types of books and libraries and vocabulary and other things in the home or in the neighborhood or community where they live. When you're taking people like that and you're putting them all in one place, which is what essentially exactly the public schools that people are most eager to get out of, and the reason why predominantly Democratic constituencies in a lot of big cities are so for school choice. When you're putting all those people in one place, it stands to reason that that place is not going to produce great results. But when you can enable those folks to go different places, and you can enable them to go wherever they think is best for their specific child, you are naturally going to get more parity in terms of resources. For example, many parochial schools that serve a socioeconomically disadvantaged population also have folks both in and around them that have chosen to be there, so that they're able to provide the types of non-economic resources like the social capital and the parental involvement that is just really hard to get if you're in a place where everyone's parent is a single parent working two jobs, right? Who is going to be there to help with the PTA? It's impossible. It's not their fault. It's just impossible.
Right. Well, I know you've got to go for some family stuff, so we'll honor your time. I feel like we could chat on this for quite a while.
Quite a while.
Yes.
I love this topic.
Yes, me too. And it's been so great to meet you both.
Yeah.
If people want to reach out, like our listeners are excited to hear more from you, where should they find you? What are the preferred avenues?
Thank you so much. And thank you again for having me. It's been so great to chat with you both. I'm on Twitter at Elizabeth G. Matt, and all my other contact info is on there as well.
Well, good. That's how we like to operate Twitter. You know, I guess Twitter is kind of like a school of choice, right? You can choose to fall down that toxic rabbit hole that exists on Twitter, or you can choose to follow some really valuable people with a lot of great insight. And I'm hoping that we can add to your followers on your Twitter, because I know I'm certainly going to add you to my personal Twitter.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And likewise.
Wow. Ryan, that was a lot of information packed into a very short amount of time.
Yes, it was. I wanted to even get into, like, just because our last episode started to talk about higher education, and she's hinting at how kids aren't writing as well. And then she, after the episode was over, I think for our listeners, she started talking about how her husband came from a place where, what'd she say, the reading level, the proficiency was zero. No wonder people want to make a choice, because either they're not even prepared for life or the college, and they just want something as an option. Sometimes I think that's part of it, which she hinted at, is it's not that you're always, you're at least, sometimes it's just the freedom to choose. Feels good.
Yeah. I guess it just, the only issue that I have with school choice, and I don't know if it's an issue or whatnot, but my only concern, and I'm sure that other people maybe feel this way, is that it could just accelerate the gap between those that can and those that can't. You know what I'm saying? I mean, because it's good to have diversity in schools as well.
It might accelerate the gap, or it puts a larger chunk of people in the group that actually can succeed. Who knows? Sometimes I think too, like public schools right now are kind of like, I don't know, let's say Apple or Microsoft. Like, I'm a monopoly, so what incentive do I have to change? Because you have very few choices with your computers, or you could say with phones, like I'm Apple or Android. Now, we don't have nothing to worry about.
Right.
And so then I think there's a little bit of that resistance too, is that people, we kind of know that people just have to come to us. Yeah. And so I don't know that that creates a natural, I guess an explicit awareness of that we're resistant to change. But I think when I notice it is like this, you've heard about this current bill that's potentially going to get passed in Kansas, where it's kind of a school choice bill.
Uh-huh.
It has people that I've talked to scared, because they assume that there's like all these narratives about it. Like, we're going to get the worst kids from the other schools. We have to pay for their transportation. And what's funny about it, I guess, or sad, is there's not a view of, boy, we better buck up our game, because we want to have an option for people to make us the choice.
Yeah. And like, Well, I alluded to this in the episode too, and I guess it's frustrating because I do know with certainty that at my public school that I am at, I have some teachers that are dynamic, that are fantastic, that are amazing. And I know that my son goes to parochial school, and I mean, you want to talk about traditional education, you know, his school is worksheet driven, homework driven, you know, in terms of collaboration time in the classroom and all those things that we're trying to push out in education. I mean, you want to talk about taking a step back in time. That's what his school looks like. Yeah. Yet his school has better results than a public school that has better teachers, mm-hmm. better technology, better yeah. this and that and this, just because they have a different funding string. And a lot of those parochial teachers or charter school teachers or private school teachers, they're not compensated as well as the public school teachers, right? Yeah. So in reality, it thinks, why would I choose to go to a place that feels like I'm walking back in time with teachers that aren't as good as the teachers that I currently have, yet still expect for my child to get a better education? And to me, that's just crazy.
Yeah. I don't know what you do with that. Like, that's the thing that is so frustrating, because public schools are gifted with usually better teachers. I mean, they would have the fuller spectrum probably than private schools, because they just have a larger system. But
yeah,
you probably have a lot. I was just reflecting on this as a side note, that I think that this unnamed district that you work for, that I used to work for when I taught, that I actually became a really good teacher because of some of the challenges, the professional development. I know we said it lacks, but it also had some really good elements to it that made me a really good teacher because it had resources, perhaps in a different way than a private school would have access to.
So does this mean that the equation for a school to be successful hinges on the social capital that is created within that school and the parental responses? And I don't know. Again, I don't want to walk on some dangerous territory here, but I'm having a hard time seeing how better teachers, better training, better everything gets worse results.
Well, here's an argument that could relate to this. My superintendent, her response to the school choice thing was, I'm all for school choice, but the charter schools, the home schools, whoever is other has to follow the same rules that we do then. And my thought is, perhaps what, and my counter argument was to actually say, no, we need to be allowed to follow the rules that they have to follow, which is very little.
Yeah.
And because I think that is what limits public education, are the excessive reports that we have to waste our time filling out to feed the government data stream. You know, even when you're talking about getting into teachers' classrooms, like, how much of my day do I waste on trainings to learn how to fill out the next report that I need to do for student data, or to create the right system to capitalize on the data that the state needs? Like, that stuff is so, it's time so poorly spent that I think public schools, unless they're accredited, they don't have to deal with. And an accreditation really means nothing, because there are some solid private schools in Wichita that are non-accredited that do not have a problem having their graduates go to any university.
Yeah.
So you can't even make that argument that the rules are worth it.
Yeah. I don't know. What I'm hoping is maybe we got somebody listening that yeah. is doing something remarkable. And if that's you, we want to hear from you, because, you know, Ryan and I have been talking. I mean, we created this podcast because we feel that education needs something different. But a lot of our guests have been people that are doing better things within the same confines of the traditional experience that we're trying to move away from. You know, so I want to know if you work at a school or if you know of a school that operates differently than what's currently being offered, and if that place is being more successful. That's our mission, Ryan. We need to find those people.
We do. So let us know. I'm at Ryan D. Bartle 1.
At Eric J. Steven. And that's an Eric with a CH and a Steven with a PH.
Oh, I like how that rhymes. He's a rapper.
I don't know if it rhymes. It's just the same letters.
It has an E and an E sound to it. I like it.
All right.
Yeah, reach out to us. Let us know. Say, hey, I've got this person I've heard of. I've listened to their podcast. I am that person. I work for them. I read an article about them. We don't care. Let us know, because we want to have them on the show, learn from them.
Absolutely. All right, Ryan. Well, as always, it has been a pleasure trying to dig into this metaphor that we've trying to solve of a peg not fitting into a hole, or the hole being the wrong size for the peg. I mean, I don't know which is which, but yep. Something doesn't fit and something's got to change. And if you are that person, hit us up and let's talk.
As always, thank you for checking us out at The Peg Doesn't Fit. We appreciate you listening. You can find us on Twitter at The Peg Doesn't Fit. You can find me at Ryan D. Bartle 1.
And my personal Twitter is at Eric J. Steven. You can also email us at thepegdoesn'tfit@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at anchor.fm/thepegdoesn'tfit.
Drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Tell your educator friends or family, anybody. We'd love to hear from you.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week on The Peg Doesn't Fit.